Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. Today, we're going to be talking about adopting a child with Down syndrome. But before we get started, I just want to remind people that most people find out about podcasts in general, and this one in specific, by being told about it by their friends. So when you're sitting around on your Zoom meeting or whatever you are doing and talking with your friends, would you do us a favor, please, and let them know about this podcast? Today, we're going to be talking about adopting a child with Down syndrome with Dr. Emily Jean Davidson. She is with the Down syndrome program at Boston Children's Hospital and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Dr. Davidson, to Creating a Family. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this important topic and one that's coming up more and more often.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, I want to start by just kind of giving, laying a little bit of groundwork here. One, because a lot of beginning parents may not know this, but we really do try to use what's called person's first language. It's preferred to say that you are going to adopt a child or would like to adopt a child with Down syndrome, not I want to adopt a Downs or a Down. People with Down syndrome really are more like us than different from us, and we want to be respectful to them as people, and that does begin in infancy. All right, so it's possible to adopt a child with Down syndrome domestically two ways, in a private infant adoption where the parents make a decision to place their child for adoption, or you can adopt a child with Down syndrome from foster care where the child has either been removed from the home or the parents have relinquished to foster care. You can also adopt a child internationally who has Down syndrome, and there are many countries with kids with Down syndrome who are waiting to be adopted. And if you're interested in adopting a child with Down syndrome, either domestically or internationally, you must have a home study that specifically approves you to adopt a child with this syndrome. And the main thing is to let your agency know that this is a special need that you are open to when they begin the home study, because the home study needs to be specific for this condition. All right, Dr. Davidson, can you tell us what is Down syndrome?
Sure. I just wanted to jump back for one moment to also note that there are some really terrific specific resources if you're thinking about adopting a child with Down syndrome. The National Down Syndrome Adoption Network provides resources and education for families who are interested in adopting a child with Down syndrome. It helps match families who want to adopt with birth families who have chosen adoption. For people who are interested in international adoption, Reese's Rainbow also helps to promote and provide support for international adoptions, even raises some funding to help contribute to the family's expenses in adoption. There are a number of other sites as well, but those are two that I just wanted to highlight as good resources. So going back to the question of what is Down syndrome? So Down syndrome is a genetic condition that's caused by having an extra copy of the 21st chromosome. It's the most common genetic cause of intellectual disability, and it's associated with certain physical characteristics and also a number of medical and developmental issues, which we'll be talking about over the course of the next hour.
Okay, excellent. So you say it's the most common. How common is it?
Currently in the United States, about one in every 700 children is born with Down syndrome, and that amounts to an estimated somewhere between 250 and 350,000 people living with Down syndrome in the U.S.
So 200 to 350,000?
Yeah.
Okay, in the U.S. Okay, excellent. So are there different types of Down syndrome?
So there are three different genetic ways to get Down syndrome. So the first one, the majority of children with Down syndrome have full trisomy 21. That's about 95%. About 4% have translocation, and about 1% have mosaicism. So let me take a minute to explain what that means. So generally, typically people have 23 pairs of chromosomes or 46 chromosomes altogether. We get half of our chromosomes from our biological mother and half from our biological father. So typically in the production of the sperm and the egg cells, there's a cell division called meiosis that takes a cell with 46 chromosomes and turns it into an egg or a sperm with just 23. So then the egg with 23 joins with the sperm with 23 to form a zygote with 46 chromosomes. And then that goes on to divide multiple times and eventually become an embryo. So in the process of that cell division to make the egg or the sperm, sometimes an extra 21 sticks to the other 21. And instead of 23 chromosomes, that cell has 24. So if an egg with 24 chromosomes combines with a sperm with 23, the embryo would then have 47 chromosomes, and the baby resulting would have a full trisomy 21, or three full copies of the 21st chromosome. So that's the most common cause about 95% of the time. In about 4% of the time, you have a piece of 21 that gets stuck on another chromosome. So the total number of chromosomes is 46, the typical number. But because of that extra piece of 21 stuck on another chromosome, most commonly on chromosome 14, you would have, in effect, three copies of 21. Then the third type of Down syndrome is when you have mosaicism. And in mosaicism, in one of the early cell divisions, an extra 21 ends up in some of the cells, but not all of them. So it's a mixture of cells that have 46 chromosomes and cells that have 47 chromosomes. So people with mosaic Down syndrome may have all of the features of other people with Down syndrome, or they may not. So some people with mosaicism have physical features that look like other people with Down syndrome and don't have as much intellectual disability, or sometimes they may have intellectual disability and not as many of the features. It overlaps, but as a population or group, the sort of developmental range of people with mosaic Down syndrome falls somewhere between the developmental range of people in the typically developing population and people with Down syndrome.
What about the other two, the translocation and the trisomy 21? Is is there a difference in how Down syndrome presents in the individual, depending on whether it has three full copies of 21 or just an extra piece of 21 stuck onto another chromosome?
We don't see any difference between those two groups in terms of how they present. The main difference, the main importance of that difference is really for families who are planning future children, that if you have translocation Down syndrome, sometimes that arises newly in the baby, but sometimes it can be passed down from a parent who carries a balanced translocation to become unbalanced in the child. So if a baby turns out to have translocation Down syndrome, then the doctors would recommend that the biologic parents have testing to find out if either of them is a carrier, to provide them with counseling for future pregnancies. If a child has regular trisomy 21, then the chance of future pregnancies is 1% plus the age-based chance.
Okay, so the chance of having a child with Down syndrome, if you have one child with Down syndrome and it's trisomy 21, you don't stand any more chance of having another child with Down syndrome other than the fact that the woman is a year older?
Not exactly. You have a very small, slight increase chance. You have a 1% plus the chance, plus whatever is associated with the age.
Okay.
Which is a very, very small increased chance, but pretty similar to the chance based on age alone.
Okay. So what are some of the common physical traits of a person with Down syndrome?
Probably the thing that most people will notice most quickly with a baby is low muscle tone. So low muscle tone is when the muscles feel a little looser. I describe it to parents who have other children. If you've ever felt how your child's muscles feel when they're sleeping, that kind of more relaxed, looser feel, that's kind of what hypotonia or low muscle tone feels like in a baby with Down syndrome. And that low muscle tone, we'll talk about a little bit more about how it impacts development, but that can help present with developmental delays as children grow. Other things that you see, small stature, adults with Down syndrome generally grow to a smaller height than the general population. You can also see a flattened facial profile. So if you look at someone from the side with Down syndrome, their nose might not stick out as much as it might for someone else. The fingers tend to be a little shorter. You can sometimes see the fifth fingers, the pinky fingers, sometimes have a little bit of an inward curve to them. Sometimes people notice the eyes can be slightly upward slanting with a little bit of a skin fold in the inner corner of the eye. You can see little white spots in the iris of the eyes. They're called brush field spots. I actually think those look really pretty. You can see a single crease across the palm of the hand or a deep groove between the first and second toes. So all of these features you can see in other people. and even whether or not they have Down syndrome, but the combination of them is more common than people who have Down syndrome.
If you see these physical characteristics in other people, particularly if you see more than one, would that be an indication that the person might have mosaic Down syndrome, or are there other syndromes that might lend themselves to some of these physical characteristics?
Some of these characteristics you might see in other syndromes, it could potentially present when someone with mosaicism and might have that. I think whether you would sort of pursue further evaluation would have to do with whether the person has any other, whether there are physical or developmental issues that made people think we should look for something else. Okay. So, for example, my nephew has a single deep crease across the palm of his hand, no other features. He's just a typically developing young man and has that characteristic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is the life expectancy of a person with Down syndrome, especially let's say one being born now?
Yeah. So for a child being born today, the current life expectancy is around 60 years of age. And this is a dramatic increase in the past 60 years. In 1960, people with Down syndrome, the average life expectancy is only 10 years old. By 1983, it had increased to age 20. So you can see this is a huge increase. And there have been people with Down syndrome who have lived up into their 80s today.
Interesting. Okay. What are the common developmental disabilities caused by this disorder? And I'm making a distinction now, developmental versus intellectual. We're going to talk about intellectual in a minute.
So when you think about young children meeting their milestones, children with Down syndrome are going to generally meet their developmental milestones a little later than their typically developing peers. Now, even in the general population, every milestone has a range of normal, a range of typical times for people to achieve the milestone. And there are people who have no developmental concerns whatsoever who will meet the milestone at the later end of that range. Similarly, with kids with Down syndrome, there's a range of the milestones as well. And there's often overlap between the typical range and the range for kids with Down syndrome. So for example, I have kids who walked on the late side and I have patients who walked before my kids did. But if you think as a general rule, if you're planning to adopt a child with Down syndrome, you want to have a ballpark, what could you expect? Developing kids usually are sitting by the time they're around 6 months old. For kids with Down syndrome, it's usually more like 7 to 9 months, and it may be later. Similarly, walking, typically we think around a year, but that range in the typical population is between 8 and 18 months. And for kids with Down syndrome, it's typically closer to 2 years, although there's a range between a year and almost 4 years. So there's a very big range. If you're interested in, similarly with talking, also first words, instead of being around 9 to 12 months, are often more around 12 to 18 months. If you're interested in reading, there's a really terrific table of developmental milestones in kids, typically developing kids and kids with Down syndrome. They're in the lettercase.org website, has some really good materials for families. So we can give that to you at the end as well.
Okay, lettercase.org. Gotcha. Okay.
Yes. So some of the things I think also then you think about, okay, what goes along with some of those also delays in development? Well, if you're developmentally learning tasks and your communication is at a more similar to a child a little bit younger, then sometimes some of the other things that would go along with a younger child, like having a shorter attention span or being a little more impulsive, can be seen in younger kids with Down syndrome. You also see the delays in language and speech development. And so one of the things that we talk about a lot in our clinic is how do we help kids communicate from as early as possible to their best ability? And one of the things I love to introduce people to is using sign language, because most kids with Down syndrome are quite good at learning things visually and by modeling. So if they see someone do something, they want to try to do that thing the way the other person did. So using signs, even some basic signs like more and eat and all that, can be a really nice way to help promote communication. we actually felt strongly enough about this that we started to give every family a sign language video when they come see us as newborns. And it doesn't have to be an overwhelming thing for a family. Just learning a handful of signs can make the difference. And then as you start to see your child use them, then it makes sense to keep using them as well. And then as the child's speech comes in, they'll stop using the signs and use their speech, and maybe just use the signs for clarification or for emphasis, like, please, mommy, I really want that thing. They might see them sign please in addition to saying it.
Mm-hmm. So those are some of the developmental. Let's talk about some of the intellectual disabilities that and the range that one might expect to see with a person with Down syndrome.
So typically, intellectual disability in people with Down syndrome falls in the mild to moderate range of intellectual disability. So someone with mild intellectual disability would be fairly independent, would be able to, we'd expect that person to be able to get themselves dressed, be independent in the bathroom, be independent, be able to make a simple meal, would be able to take a public transportation to get to work, would be able to have a job. Someone with moderate intellectual disability might be able to do some of those things, but might need some more supports, reminders, prompts to help them do be their most independent. So those are the kinds of, okay. That's the range.
Is there a way to know in advance how intellectually impacted a child might be? I mean, what are some of the ways to try to determine the degree of impact if you're adopting a child, say, who is not a newborn, or even at newborn, but I would assume that you would have more information as a child ages?
Right. So this is a very challenging question because there are so many factors that come into play, including the child's age, underlying medical issues, the child's living environment, the caregivers that the child currently has. And even, I meet with parents who are expecting babies with Down syndrome prenatally, and one of the things everybody would like to be able to know is how will my child do intellectually? How will they do developmentally? And there's no crystal ball at any point. And so we can know what we can do to help support them. But if you're thinking about an adoption of a child who is past newborn, starting to ask questions like, how are they doing with their developmental milestones? Have they started walking? Are they talking? How do they communicate? Looking at their fine motor milestones, can they hold a toy or scribble with a pen? Looking at pictures or videos can be helpful. Asking about their health history, learning about their living situation, and particularly the child's relationships with caregivers and other children, that can give you some glimpse into their social skills and their interest in communication. You can ask what the child likes to do. Are they primarily doing just self-stimulatory, looking at a single toy, waving it back and forth, or are they trying to engage with other children, trying to build if they have opportunities to use blocks or other toys? So if you want to have a sense of that, the milestones, again, I had given you the resource lettercase.org, but there's actually a more easier to remember link for it, which is understandingdownsyndrome.org. So understandingdownsyndrome.org has an online pamphlet on Down syndrome that has the milestones chart included in it. But even with that, I've seen kids with Down syndrome who were adopted, particularly from settings where there wasn't a lot of developmental stimulation, and I've seen them make huge strides developmentally once they got adopted into loving families who provided the structure and developmental stimulation. So we'll talk a little bit later on about how you can help support development for your child.
So if you're considering adopting a child with Down syndrome, what type of resources do you need to have lined up? What type of interventions, both those that you have to seek out on your own or those that are readily available and provided without cost, and things that you should think about at the beginning so that your child stands the best chance of developing as fully as possible within the range of their capabilities?
That's an excellent question. So For children who are between birth and three, they'll be eligible for early intervention services, which are services that are provided by every state in the U.S. Each area provides those through regional and local programs so that they can be provided in the child's natural environment, which is if your child is at home, they'll be at home. If your child is in daycare, they can be in daycare. And they'll start first, someone from the team will come out, they'll make an individualized family service plan with your family about what are your goals for your child and then what kinds of services will they get. And the types of services that early intervention offers include things like developmental specialists who can give you ideas for what sorts of activities to do with your child. And they'll also do hands-on play with the child to show you some of those and to work with the child directly. Physical therapists who work on gross motor skills, things like sitting, walking, crawling. Occupational therapists who work on fine motor skills, things like drawing or using a finger to point. And then speech therapists who work on speech, language, and communication. Sometimes feeding will be topics that can be addressed by occupational therapists or speech therapists. And then other specialists are sometimes added on if the child has specific needs. Typically around age two, a lot of early interventions will begin to offer some group classes with other children in early intervention so that kids can begin to develop the skills they will need to be in a classroom, like sitting in a circle to read a story with a teacher, being in a room and playing with other kids. So that's sort of the early intervention year.
Is there a charge for early intervention?
So early intervention is available. Everybody is eligible for it. If you have insurance, typically your insurance will pay for some of it. And there's a parental contribution that is based on family financial situation. Mm-hmm. But it's available for free if you don't have the means, then it's available for free. So everybody can access it.
So that's up to age three.
That's up to age three.
Yeah. What should parents be prepared to do? What will kids typically need throughout the rest of their preschool years and school years?
So at age three, actually between age two and three, part of early intervention's mandate is to help families make the transition to preschool. So from age three up until age 21, and some states define 21 as the moment the child turns 21, and some states define it as the moment the child turns 22, so you'll always do that 21st year. But in any case, from three to 21, the public education provides services for kids. And so every child has the right to a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment, which means that if the child can be in an inclusion setting where they're working alongside kids who are typically developing, that's what they should have. And we see a lot of benefits for kids with Down syndrome to be included in typical classes because that gives them a chance to learn the skills and model from their peers. And also to build friendships that will be supportive to them over time. And so families sometimes will, and when you're in the school system, sorry, you will be able to get the speech, physical therapy, occupational therapy services that were in early intervention previously, and all of that is without cost to the family. Sometimes families feel like they would like to go above and beyond what's being offered at school and will seek out private therapies in addition, which are often covered by insurance. But at a baseline, you at least have the services that are going to be provided through the school.
And that's part of the regular public education.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes families who choose another route for education, such as homeschooling, will still get their services through the public school. So they might bring the child in to do the physical therapy and occupational therapy through school, even if their child were enrolled in a different private school or homeschooling.
Okay.
But for most kids, it's helpful to be in that public school environment because they get, they have a peer group, and that's where the services are mandated to be provided mm-hmm. for them.
Okay. Let me remind people that this show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Since 2005, Jockey Being Family has been a leader in providing post-adoption support to strengthen adoptive families for successful futures. Jockey Being Family connects adoptive parents and children with education and resources to help prevent failed adoptions. They believe one failed adoption is one too many. And you can connect with them on their social media platforms, Facebook and Instagram. They go by Jockey Being Family. And they also have a website, jockeybeingfamily.com. And you can get more information and donate to their mission by going to their website. Okay, we have talked about the developmental and the intellectual issues that can arise and often do arise with children with Down syndrome. Let's talk about with some of the common medical conditions that accompany trisomy 21. I think that a lot of people we all know that people with Down syndrome may have intellectual impacts, but I think that a lot of people, until they get involved in this, don't realize that there are common medical conditions. Having an extra chromosome impacts more than just intellectual development.
Exactly. Yes. In fact, it seems like almost every part of the body has something that can happen a little more often in people with Down syndrome than in the general population. And so I want to tell you about these, but also realize that nobody gets every single one of them. So it's important to know what these issues are. And also, these are the kinds of things, if you're adopting, that you should ask about: does this child have this condition? Has this child been screened for this condition? To find out, sometimes there may be conditions that where the child is, they might not have known to do the testing. Or so sometimes I've seen kids from international adoptions who haven't yet had a cardiac echo. So we'll talk about the heart first. So heart defects are quite common in kids with Down syndrome. About 40 to 50% of kids with Down syndrome have a heart defect when they're born. Fortunately, the vast majority of these are things that can be corrected with heart surgery. And the fact that we do heart surgery now and routinely for kids with Down syndrome when they have cardiac defects is part of what has increased the life expectancy so dramatically from what it was earlier in the century. Or in the last century. The most common type of heart defect is called a common atrioventricular canal defect. And in that you see defects in the walls between the atria, the filling chambers of the heart, and the ventricles, the pumping chambers of the heart, and also some issues with the valves. For most of the kids who have that condition, the majority, if they have it, they'll be able to go home, grow, and then have the cardiac defect corrected sometime in the first 3 to 6 months of life. Other heart defects, sometimes you can see just an isolated defect in the ventricular septal defect, like the wall that separates the two pumping chambers of the heart. Some of those just go, and the atrial septal defect, similarly, the two filling chambers can have a defect in that wall. Some of those ASDs and VSDs just go away over time without anything being done, to any intervention needed at all. And some of them can just be watched over time. And then if they haven't resolved by the time a child is 3 or 4, they may be able to do an intervention. They may do an intervention surgically or with a catheter-placed device that goes into a small, into the vessels of the leg and gets threaded up to the heart and just expands into the hole. They may be able to correct it that way. So the cardiac defects, while they're certainly serious and important, are typically quite manageable with surgical intervention. Some of the other things, so right off the bat, in the first weeks of life, we recommend getting a cardiac echo. If the child you're adopting has not had an echo yet, regardless of their age, they should just have one at baseline to make sure everything looks okay. Sometimes you can have a cardiac defect without having an obvious murmur that the doctor can hear. So it's important just to do that cardiac echo. Other things that we check in newborns and then check throughout the childhood, we look at for hearing loss. So every baby in our state gets a hearing test when the baby's born. And I think that's pretty universal now. kids with Down syndrome have a higher chance of having hearing loss for two reasons. One is called conductive hearing loss, and the other is called sensory neural hearing loss. For young infants, what conductive hearing loss is that the sound is not able to get from the outside of the ear into the inner ear. And what happens is, if you think about the difference between adults and children, adult ears are bigger, children's ears are smaller. That's more pronounced for kids with Down syndrome. Also, the tube that drains the middle ear is narrower and flatter for kids, and particularly for kids with Down syndrome compared with adults. So if you have other kids, you may have had kids who have had ear infections, and that's because that middle ear doesn't drain well. Sometimes if the middle ear doesn't drain well, you can just have fluid, so it's not an actual infection, but there's just fluid there that is preventing the sound from traveling through the small bones in the inner ear into the to get to the cochlea to send that signal to the brain. So you can have that conductive hearing loss. And we check hearing frequently because of that. We check hearing at birth around 6 to 8 months, and then every 6 months until the child can have each ear tested separately. And then we continue to check at least once a year, because sometimes kids can develop a sensory neural hearing loss later on.
So what is a sensory neural hearing loss?
So that's when the nerves of the process of sound aren't working well. And so kids who have a sensory neural hearing loss might need to have a hearing aid, and there isn't a surgery like the tubes that you could put in to help drain the middle ear, which would help conductive loss. There isn't a specific thing like that you can do, but you're more supporting with hearing aids to make sure they're hearing well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so we know that if there's fluid, it's a fairly common condition, kids have fluid in their ears, and the general treatment for that is to put tubes in, so allow the fluid to drain out, and so then the ear and the functions, the little bones inside the ear function the way they're without being gunked up with fluid. But for a sensory neural, that is a different issue and would require a hearing specialist as well as perhaps something like hearing aids.
Right. And if the child has the conductive loss, we'd also have a ear, nose, and throat doctor and a hearing specialist checking to make sure everything's okay. And if they needed the tubes, that would be the job of the ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Okay, so we've talked about the heart and we've talked about the ears. What are some other systems of our bodies that are typically impacted with children with trisomy 13 or 21?
So vision is another important one. About 15% or so can have small cataracts, and cataracts are opacification of the lens. If there's a big enough cataract that it makes it impossible to see, then that could need surgery, but that's a very small percentage of children. But we check because we just want to make sure that's not there. So that's when they should check with an early eye exam, either when the baby is born or when you adopt the baby. Kids can also have nearsightedness, farsightedness, a lazy eye. So we have kids see eye doctors at least once a year from age 1 to 5, at least every other year until they're 13, at least every 3 years until they're 21. And I want to mention too that these guidelines, the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2011 updated the health supervision guidelines for kids with Down syndrome. And there's a great paper that's available online if you want to see the technical doctor version. Mm-hmm. And then also they have published, the AAP has published parent copies of the guidelines to go age by age of what to look for, what are the health screenings, et cetera. So we've got heart, eyes, ears. The thyroid is another thing that we check pretty closely. So at birth, we get a thyroid stimulating hormone as well as a regular thyroxine level. And then we check it 6 months, a year, and then annually, because sometimes kids can develop hypothyroidism. And the thyroid is important, not just for metabolism, but also for growth and brain development. So if someone's thyroid is low, which is more common in kids with Down syndrome, then we can give them thyroid hormone to replace what they need, and they'll do very well. But then they would have an endocrine doctor following them as well.
Okay.
We also check for things like anemia, because sometimes kids, if their diet isn't great, they may not be getting enough iron. Another issue that's a big issue as kids with Down syndrome grow up is obstructive sleep apnea. So we do screening sleep studies for kids with Down syndrome by age 4, even if they haven't had set symptoms. But if they're having symptoms before then, they're snoring a lot, pausing when they're sleeping, having the kind of a gasping, catching their breath sort of sound while they're sleeping, we would get a sleep study to find out if they have sleep apnea and whether they need any treatment for that.
Okay. Any other physical things that we need to think about?
Sometimes kids can be born with congenital abnormalities of their digestive system. So sometimes they have an intestinal blockage that needs surgery at birth. About 12% can have that. They can have constipation or reflux, which are common in the general population, but a little more common in kids with Down syndrome. I think one of the ones that's sort of the scary one, it's pretty rare, but still is, there's leukemia, about 1% of kids. There's a particular kind of leukemia that happens in young children with Down syndrome, with a condition called transient myeloproliferative disorder, or transient abnormal myeloproliferative, which in that condition, you see pre-leukemic cells that should not be in the general circulating blood. You can see them when you do a blood test. So when you do the initial complete blood count on a baby when they're born, you could see those. Typically, it's transient. That's why it's called the transient myeloproliferative disorder, which means it will go away over time without intervention. But sometimes if it's there, it can evolve into a form of leukemia. So if a child has those pre-leukemic blast cells on a blood test in the newborn period, then they'll get their blood tested a little bit more frequently, follow with a hematology specialist to make sure that it goes away, or if it does not go away, then they'll get treatment for the leukemia.
Okay, it occurs to me there are so many medical potential parts of the body that could have issues. And normally we see individual doctors for our heart, for our eyes, for our ears, for our digestive tract, for our thyroid, for our gut. So is there are there many places such as the center that you're affiliated with, the Down Syndrome Program at Boston Children's, are there other centers like that, that where you could, if a parent who is adopting a child or fostering a child with Down, there's one place they can go where everybody works in concert and understands and is looking holistically at this child?
Yeah, I think that brings up a really good point with which we try to do in our Down Syndrome program. So there are Down Syndrome programs across the country, and we can give a link to the National Down Syndrome Society has a place where you can look to see who's near you. And these are often multidisciplinary teams, and at a minimum have doctors in them who see a lot of kids with Down syndrome. So some of the things that might be more subtle and might not be noticed in a general pediatric visit, we might realize is occurring because of the number of kids that we see with Down syndrome. So these programs are often staffed by either developmental pediatricians, which is my background, or geneticists. You can also see specialists like physical therapists, speech therapists, nutritionists, psychologists. They're also tend to work closely with the other specialists within their organizations in their area, so that if we saw someone and I picked up a new heart murmur, for example, I would then send them to a cardiology colleague, even though I don't have a cardiologist specifically in my clinic, I would know where to send them. So I think that can be tremendously helpful. I think if you're thinking about adopting a child with Down syndrome, either internationally or locally, you may also want to think about a developmental pediatrician who has expertise in adoption to talk about some of the adoption-related issues as well. And then if you identify a specific defect, like a cardiac defect or specific medical issue, then a specialist in that area would make sense to connect with as well.
Okay. Yeah. And so the National Down Syndrome Society has a list of Down syndrome programs, and we will link to that so that it's important before you bring this child home to locate one, even if they're not nearby, to at least get second opinions or to at least consult with your pediatrician if they are too far away for you to seek out, or at least seek out on a regular basis to bring your child to. Yeah. All right.
And I think also now with the advent of more telehealth, it may be easier to seek out care from a remote program in the future. So even if you don't live near a program, you may be able to have a consultation via mm-hmm. telemedicine.
And oftentimes it will work hat in hand with your own doctor, with your own pediatrician. So it's
absolutely. Yeah. They don't take the place of your pediatrician, but collaborate.
Right. Yeah. And so having that lined up and making certain that whatever pediatrician you choose is willing to do that. And the vast majority are not only willing, they will be encouraging you to do that. This show is brought to you by the support of our partners. And these are agencies that believe in our mission of supporting and educating and training families pre-adoption, post-adoption, pre-fostering, and then during the fostering process. And they believe in it enough that they put their money where their beliefs are. And that's one of the reasons that we can bring you this show and all the resources we provide at Creating a Family. One such agency is Children's Connection. They're an adoption agency providing services for domestic infant adoption and embryo donation and adoption throughout the U.S. They also do home studies and post-adoption support to families throughout Texas. And we have Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited international adoption agency placing children from Armenia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Georgia, Ghana, Guyana, Morocco, Pakistan, Serbia, Ukraine, and they specialize in the placement of children with Down syndrome, as well as other special needs. And they also are a specialist in kinship, international kinship adoptions. And we thank them for their support. All right, we've talked about intellectual, we've talked about developmental, we've talked about medical conditions. Let's talk about some behavioral and mental health issues that may be more common in people and children with Down syndrome.
Sure. And I think it makes sense to think about these a little bit in kind of developmental timeframes as well. So for young children and early school age children who have difficulty with their language and communication skills, they can also have behaviors that come out around having those delays in language and cognition, and also nonverbal problem solving abilities. And that can leave them with some vulnerability. So they might be more apt to have difficulty with impulsivity or inattention, hyperactivity. We can see kids who have a co-diagnosis of attention deficit disorder. But sometimes even without necessarily having a full diagnosis, they might just have some impulsivity because they're, they might be a third grader, but they have some delays in their language and their cognitive skills. They may not be quite as ready as their same age peers to be sitting at a desk all day, making the shift from learning to read to reading to learn. And that may make it harder for them in the classroom to attend to their work, and they may need some different supports. So that's something that we can see. You can also sometimes see one area, actually in younger and older kids, but you might pick it up as they're in the younger kids, is autism spectrum disorder. In the general population, it's more common than it was in the past, but in kids with Down syndrome, the rate of autism, we believe, is somewhere around 10%, which is quite a bit higher than the general population. And it's interesting because in general, most people with Down syndrome are known for being very socially interactive and engaging, but there's a subset of kids with Down syndrome who also have features of autism and have a much harder time with social relatedness and connecting with other people.
Okay. So other mental health issues as we move through the school age to adolescence that we as parents need to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, so adolescents, sometimes school age kids can have some anxiety, sometimes get fears, fears of dogs, fears of different things. And kids in their adolescent years, you see a little more of the depression or social withdrawal kinds of symptoms or generalized anxiety, sometimes some obsessive compulsive behaviors. sleep issues and sleep, obstructive sleep apnea can play in here as well as in younger kids. If your sleep is disrupted, it can affect your ability to attend. It can affect your ability to cope. But some of the things to try to think of us, what can we do, to what protective factors can we put in, starting to work on making sure that you develop a community of friends from early on so that kids stay involved in activities and involved with other kids and have those supports among their peers, and find things that they're interested in doing. Keeping kids exercising could be really important. We didn't talk about overweight, but overweight is more common. Overweight and obesity is more common in people with Down syndrome, and exercise, which is helpful for that, is also very helpful for keeping kids more engaged and feeling better emotionally. We also look out for things like regression. Sometimes you can see regression in the context of something that has happened socially. We also look for other medical issues. If regression is never normal, so if somebody's at a certain developmental level and then you see them not able to do what they could do before, we always have to look to figure out what's going on, why did that happen. And then for older adults, there's a higher rate of Alzheimer's and dementia in adults. So that's something as people get into their 30s and 40s. So that happens at a younger age than in the general population. So we start to worry about that in the adults. I primarily take care of children, so I haven't worked with as many adults, but that's our adult colleagues work on that.
So not only is it more common, it happens at a younger age.
Yes, more common and happens at a younger age.
Okay. So a question that a lot of parents wonder, who are either expecting a child with Down syndrome or are considering the adoption of one, is will my child be able to live and be independent as an adult, or do I need to plan on them always being dependent on me?
Mm-hmm. So some people with Down syndrome are able to live independently in adulthood. A nice example I always like to talk about is Nate Simons, who works in our clinic. He works as a patient liaison, and he originally started as an intern coming into our clinic a couple of days a week. And over time, not only did he become such an essential part of our team that we extended and said he was no longer an intern but was an employee, but the whole floor decided they wanted to have him working with them as well. And he now is the first person with Down syndrome to have a 40-hour-a-week full-time job at Children's Hospital. He lives independently by himself in an apartment, gets himself to work independently, but he still relies on his parents for some help with financial decisions, things like that. So even when people with Down syndrome are quite independent, they still may need some support from their families. More often, adults with Down syndrome do live with other people, either with their family members, or they might live in an apartment with a support staff person who might be just helping to make sure that if they have any questions or an emergency comes up, that there's somebody there. And then some people live in group situations. Sometimes parents will get together and purchase a home for a group of kids, or there may be ones that are run by other organizations in your state. But there's a wide variety, and I'd say over time, people with Down syndrome are becoming have more and more opportunity for independent living. But I would anticipate as a parent that you would have significant involvement in your child's life throughout their lifespan.
And that involves not only you, but it involves your finances, because you will need to prepare to financially be able to support them. And it also affects your children, because you won't always be here. And hopefully your children, all of them, will outlive you. And so it also involves your children oftentimes taking over the responsibility of being that additional support.
Yeah. And my experience is that siblings tend to be very possessive of having that role and to want to take a role and expect their parents and hope their parents will involve them in it, to have their sibling either live with them when they're older or at least be highly involved in it. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents wonder about impact on other siblings. And as a group, I think siblings of people with Down syndrome tend to become much more involved in advocacy. We see a lot of people in helping professions becoming doctors or speech therapists. It can really open their eyes and bring out some really wonderful characteristics, mm-hmm. their experiences, sticking up for their sibling and looking out for their sibling and learning about what their sibling means.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ready-made way of learning compassion and giving you the opportunity to care and think about others throughout your life.
Yeah. Another resource that I realized we haven't really talked about yet is just the local Down syndrome program, local and national. So the National Down Syndrome Congress and the National Down Syndrome Society have tremendous resources on all of these topics. So I really would recommend going there and spending a little time doing some research. That those are great, reliable sources of information. They have information across the lifespan. So very useful. The National Down Syndrome Congress runs a national meeting every year for families. Next summer, you may want to go to that and learn more, meet people, talk with families, but even your local group, just find your local group and find out what are people's experiences in the schools? What has been helpful for their kids? Becoming part of that network is tremendously helpful. And it's the most welcoming group of parents that you can possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. So I highly recommend that.
So what makes the difference in the prognosis of an infant born with Down syndrome? I mean, how important are things like access to early intervention, well-prepared parents, a loving, stable home, things like that, as far as we know that these children are born with a range of capabilities, and not necessarily, I'm not speaking necessarily of their physical, but as far as where, from an intellectual, a behavioral, and an emotional standpoint, where along the range that they were born with, where will they fall, and what makes a difference?
All of those things that you mentioned, I think, make a big difference. There's some level that there's probably a person's capacity to learn and develop that maybe that you may not be able to influence, but there's a huge amount of difference that it makes to sit down with your child, talk to them, play with them, teach them to communicate, reinforce that communication, teach them to read. You know, being able to read opens so many doors, help them become independent, help them set high expectations for behavior and for our community, becoming part of the community, including the child in the community. Another big factor in the increase in lifespan has been the change from people being in institutions to people being in families, and being in a family and surrounded by a loving family with expectations and hopes is hugely important. And that's the amazing role that you have the opportunity to play when you decide that you're going to adopt a baby or a child with Down syndrome.
Well, you get the last word here. So why should a family consider adopting a child with Down syndrome?
I think there are a number of things that really come to mind. The first is that community, and just you become part of a really wonderful group of people. Second is just how much fun people with Down syndrome can be. I really love to spend time just hanging out and being playful with people with Down syndrome. I teach some yoga to kids with Down syndrome, and they're fun. They really enjoy themselves. And then their empathy, their compassion, and their how tender they can be towards you is something that's just wonderful for families. In my experience, there's many people with Down syndrome who just have wonderful senses of humor and wonderful ability to live in the moment and to slow down a little bit and appreciate what's there and really have just a wonderful connection. So those are all the things that I think about. It's a wonderful group of people, and I think you'll change your life in so many ways and so many wonderful ways.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Emily Davidson, with the Down Syndrome Program at Boston Children's and as a professor at Harvard Medical School, for talking with us today about the full range of issues associated with adopting a child with Down syndrome. Let me remind people that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your adoption or foster care professional. Thank you for joining us today, everyone, and I will see you next week.